Would you like to introduce our guests?
Yes, we are here with...
Got a house full.
We do. We have the whole family. Maybe not
just
the whole family.
Us, yeah.
Only three.
Are there more?
Two dogs and a cat.
Oh, okay.
They count.
Yeah, but they're not allowed in here.
No. They're in the car.
We're talking, we're hearing the voice of Rich
Klin.
You know, I had it down, and then the minute I got on air...
It. It's burdened me my entire life.
K-L-I-N, you know? Klin.
Period. Four letters. Yeah,
that's, yeah, very easy.
Yeah. Well, not, apparently.
And Lily Prince, who's the illustrator of the book called Abstract
Expression.
And also your wife. And also my wife.
Aha.
And collaborative partner.
Abstract Expressionism for Beginners.
Yes.
So you're partly here to talk about the book, but you're also doing a presentation this coming Sunday?
We are going to be at Golden Notebook.
Saturday.
Yep. Saturday, sorry.
Golden Notebook on Tinker Street in Woodstock this Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And then next week.
Oh, next week is Jack Shaiman.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's Friday, September 16th, 6 o'clock also, at the Jack Shaiman Gallery, the school in Kinderhook.
Same presentation, both locations?
I'm not sure exactly. Uh-huh. I think the Shaiman crowd might be different than the Golden Notebook crowd. I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to pitch it. But essentially.
I just want to say to everybody out there, if they haven't been to the school, they should get in there.
To the Jack Shaiman School. It's
amazing.
Amazing. Space.
It's really just like this incredible museum-like structure of, like, I think 30,000 square feet. Beautiful.
Yes, it is. I've been there, and Ellen's been there too, I believe.
I have, and they did a great job of adapting it for that use.
Yeah, we're very excited about
it. So come see us next Friday, the 16th.
So explain to it's you're not just doing a reading from the book, right? This is a full presentation. What is
we've used the word presentation sort of in a really loose sense. I don't think the book lends itself to a classic reading. You know, part of it we're going to discuss Lily's illustrations, the sort of impetus behind the writing of the book, how we did it.
But it's very informal. It's a chat. It's a little chat about abstract expressionism.
I see.
Yeah.
For beginners.
Right.
Will it be slides?
No.
No slides?
No slides.
Because it occurs to me, one of the limitations of the book is that you don't use any of the original artwork that you're talking about.
Right.
I assume that's because of rights and those kind of problems.
It's also the format of the For Beginners books, which sort of distills, all the books distill sort of these weighty topics. There's Noam Chomsky for Beginners, classical music. Their practice is it's text and graphics, not just reproductions. I mean, I think that makes the book series somewhat idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a standard art history book where there's a reproduction of Rothko or de Kooning or whatever. Not that that isn't valid and a wonderful thing to study, but it's a different idea.
Yeah, I think if it was just really a lot of reproductions, it would be a nice academic book, but we've all seen those, you know, those of us who have been to art school or museums, you know, up on the wall, the text accompanying a show. But this is really the interpretation of abstract expressionism through the eyes of an illustrator.
But it is for beginners, so you kind of... sort of looking for. So let's go. We'll talk about your illustrations then. How did you perceive your agenda, whatever you want to call it, your motive or your what you needed to do to bring home what is abstract expressionism without actually reproducing sort of the paintings themselves?
You know, my first thought when approached with this possible subject was, oh my, I don't think I'm really interested. You know, I'm an abstract landscape painter. Mm-hmm. I'm not an illustrator. And the task seemed daunting. But the more I thought about it, you know, I went to art school. I went to RISD. And then I went to Bard for my MFA. And all my professors were professors who had been, you know, studying with either abstract expressionists themselves or the first generation of their students. And I was raised on all of these stories and little anecdotes about the abstract expressionists, you know, like, well, de Kooning was at the Cedar Bar and, you know, Rothko walked in and slapped, you know, Gorky on the back and blah, blah, blah. So I was really brought up on all of those stories. And I realized that my painting style, of course, also is very gestural. And it's just, you know, almost something that I've just always had in my consciousness without really thinking about it. I never thought of myself as the greatest devotee of their work, but of course that's what I was reared on. So I kind of entered the subject realizing that this is who I am, and we all have been so influenced by these people, all of us in my generation. So I think I'm told I'm the first artist who actually ever did portraits of the abstract expressionists.
Well, that was my next question. Then you had to actually do line portraits of various
which I found
figures.
Really interesting and really challenging and exciting.
Something you don't normally do, right?
Nothing like my normal work, no. But I just took out, you know, tons of books from the library and researched, you know, all of them and researched their work, refreshed my memory, and then did portraits of them with their work surrounding them for the most part. That's most of the portraits.
Yeah,
I did.
The portraits are, to my mind, because I've read a lot of these beginner books in the other, not just this series, but there's also been one from Writers and Readers and Pantheon way back. And the caricatures, if you want to call them, of the people discussed are like the strength of that series to a degree, because it does make it more accessible to other. I mean, somehow it just makes it more. I mean, if it had just been the abstract material, it would have been a little different.
Right, right.
Which brings me to a question for you, Richard. Lily mentioned, you know, some of the anecdotes she'd heard going to art school. A lot of those kind of anecdotes are part of the history of the school, if you want to call the school. Right? I mean, it's as much about their work as it seems to be about the lore of them.
Absolutely.
Sort of, and you point out how they're affiliated in time with the Beat Generation, with the movements in jazz, and of course those two things have also become enshrouded in lore, more than actual sometimes accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how did you decide to negotiate that between just telling anecdotes and trying to explain exactly what they were trying to do?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the word negotiate, because the whole writing of the book was a negotiation. You know, we were trying to make it, obviously it's a book, not a heavy academic tome. So in some respects, I wanted it to be funny in a way, or slightly irreverent. And it's a constant balance. You know, I didn't want it to be full of, you know, colorful anecdotes about these oddball painters. But you can't ignore that also, too, because there was a sort of PR aspect to it. It's a constant negotiation. You know, I mean, the whole writing of the book was a balancing act. You know, I don't want it to be not dealing with this. You don't want it to devolve into nothing but gossip also, too. But it'd be irresponsible not to talk about that, because a lot of it was an element of self-cultivation. I mean, Jackson Pollock really built up this image of this sort of crazy, dissipating painter, and he was, but that was also part of the persona. And the Abexers, a lot of them were shrewd in a way about projecting a self-image or a PR image.
Right, much the way, I suppose, Ginsberg promoted Kerouac.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Much the way the legend of Charlie Parker sometimes exceeds, you know, what people actually know about his work.
Yeah. I mean, to be silly, either emphasis, I mean, to me, it's a balancing act, which in some ways, writing is a balancing act. But, I mean, I didn't want it to be 200 pages of funny anecdotes at the same point. You can't ignore that, you know. I mean, in all of them, not just Pollock. I mean, there was through many of them, a real cultivated, if not wildness, sort of eccentricity. Barnett Newman made this famous comment about criticism for the artist is what ornithology is for the birds. Sort of that they were sort of unencumbered by theory, by any kind of formal structure, but that was real nonsense. I mean, a lot of them were really erudite practitioners.
And you provide portraits of the two major critics who sort of came to define what was going on, Harold Rosenberg and Clement Greenberg.
Exactly, yeah.
And they actually had very close, I mean, they went on studio. I mean, the artists would invite them to their studios, wouldn't they?
Well, it was like a leapfrog. Clement Greenberg sort of really cultivated Pollock's career. The more famous Pollock got, the more Clement Greenberg sort of had art cred. It was sort of a real push me pull you in a way on some level, which probably would run into ethical issues these days, but there was no sense of conflict of interest back then.
Yeah. So, go ahead, Alan.
Sometimes when I think of Jackson Pollock, I think of that photograph of him standing over his canvas, I think of that more than I think of the painting.
Right,
and that's part of a really big part of his persona.
And
the way he died and the whole story.
It's very much a double-edged sword. I mean, I think I remember seeing the first time I saw Pollock in a museum decades ago, and I was struck by the symmetry and the sort of complicated aspect of it. And it wasn't some guy out there flinging paint. There was some real thought to it. And I think that that's where the negotiation, Pollock, there was an element of him being really misconstrued, but he also added to that. He certainly didn't broadcast the fact that there was a spiritual side to him, that there was, you know, real intent to his painting. You know, a lot of it was sort of societal misconceptions, but it was also, he really projected, there was sort of a real Hemingway element. He was the rough, you know, rough painter who was going to stand there, you know, looking brawny, standing on his canvas. So that is like the double-edged sword in a way. You know.
I just want to say, I think this is one of the reasons why the book is so important and actually so interesting, is because, you know, people do know these little anecdotes, but they, like you're saying, they don't really know the facts behind, you know, the lives of these people and how their lives related to the times they were living in politically and what was really going on. So it's actually really fascinating, you know, to kind of dig deeper, but still have it be just an enjoyable read.
One of the questions I had for you was also involved a lot of there's portraits of the major artists, portraits of those two critics. You make a case for the women of the generation being undervalued in their time. Mm-hmm. You think that's still the case, or do you feel your book is partly a correction to that, or has scholarship caught up with the women of the...
Scholarship is catching up. I think there's been a
just
huge...
Just now. Just now. There's a huge show right now as we speak at the Denver Art Museum, which is focusing on all the unknown women of abstract expressionism. And we would have loved to have included more women in our book, and people of color, and, you know, everybody. But this is sort of meant for a very mainstream mm-hmm. audience, you know, people just wanting sort of the typical average take on what the movement was about.
But yeah, I think the scholarship has started to catch up. Some of the women painters, they've been sort of rescued from obscurity in a lot of ways. I mean, Lee Krasner is being recognized not simply as Jackson Pollock's long-suffering wife. You know, there is a lot of welcome revisionism going on. Not enough, I don't think. One of the painters, Grace Hartigan, is still sort of a painter's painter and hasn't quite gotten her critical due. But I imagine this is, you know, spectacular compared to a couple decades ago when they really were buried.
Do you think that this book will in any way be used as a textbook or required reading?
I've been thinking about that. It's sort of neither fish nor fowl, you know. I mean, I hope it's erudite. The graphics and the format, I think, sometimes work against it being an academic tone. I think it should be, you know. I think that's up to... I don't have a say in that. You know, it's not an academic book.
As an art professor myself, I would highly recommend this to any professors out there listening.
Right, that's what I meant to say.
You know, I think it's a really enjoyable, easy read, and I think the illustrations, you know, really help that along, and I think that it would be a perfect academic book, but it's not intended as that.
Right. I have a couple questions about specific things in the book. For example, at one point you say that it's been determined, I think you mentioned even neurology, how they or some study that determined that not everybody, in answer to the common complaint that anybody could do it.
Right. Your kid could do it.
Your kid could do it. There was some kind of study done, and you didn't really go into detail about that. I'm kind of curious about that because I wondered what that study actually proved.
I think that it sort of tried to lay the rest of the canard. I mean, it was almost this idea, my kid could do this, was mm-hmm. almost this enshrined concept that still goes on,
sure.
I think you've had...
About most modern art.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... So this is one study, I think, that tried to have people identify kids' art and regular grown-up art. And I guess the point of that was to do something to debunk this real pernicious misconception that's gone mm-hmm. on forever. And it was such a tagline, my kid could do that. And I think that... I didn't want to give a whole scientific array right. of why this is false, but it's mostly to debunk that a little bit.
Right, but I'm just curious, what is that science? Is there really science?
There was an actual study, I think, where there was some kind of empirical test uh-huh. about could subjects identify who had painted what, and I don't have any more in-depth yeah. detail.
And they still do that today. You know, they'll have an elephant, you know, hold a paintbrush sure. and make paintings.
I guess the reason I'm curious about that is because even if you acknowledge that, you know, they are paintings by virtue of so many things, mm. like their art. How do you... Well, maybe your book shows that there's skill involved. That's the question.
Right.
Is there really skill involved?
I think
that
absolutely.
Someone else couldn't do just come up and drip paint on a canvas.
Emphatically, yes. Absolutely emphatically. I think that's what I wanted to get across
right.
also, too. You know, and a lot of it takes seeing it actually in person, I think. When I saw Ad Reinhardt's black work, it's significantly more complicated than some guy painting black and selling it for a lot of money. I mean, there's a lot of subtlety. There are gradations. There's gray. It's very, very different.
But I think what people tend to forget about this topic is that there's passion involved and belief. You know, it's an entire belief system. It's somebody's whole life that they're devoting to this kind of work. And it's not just mm-hmm. somebody, you know, randomly, you know, splattering paint on a whim.
Right. Right. But you could be passionate and have no talent.
Well, sure. Talent's a whole other issue, though, right?
Right.
We're talking about believability
of intention. As a teacher, do you actually take your students through the principles of abstract expressionism at all?
You know, I'm not an art history professor. I'm a studio art professor.
But I meant in your studio practice. How do you teach abstraction? Or do you?
I don't think you really do specifically teach abstraction. I think, you know, in my upper level classes, students do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. They pursue something that really is interesting to them. And I try to help support them move forward with it.
What if they came in and were a traditional landscape painter?
Great. If that's what they want to continue doing, fantastic. So then, you know, we find a way for them to make those paintings either outside in plein air or from photos or from little, you know, memory or, you know, something like that. So whatever somebody wants to pursue is valid. And as long as they have passion and dedication and interest, and then I help them, you know, find a better way to do it. But their students are still today, you know, talking about things like that. Like, oh, my kid brother could do that. Mm-hmm. And it's still that same argument left over from generations ago. So I find that sort of fascinating that argument has, continued in American culture.
Ellen's quite the painter, I believe. Aren't you?
You could call it abstract expressionism.
Should we call it abstract expressionism?
Anyway, no, I've never thought of myself as a visual artist. I've left that to others. My sister was the visual one. Oh. So in my family, I chose not to be.
Okay.
I guess.
Yeah. And your daughter is with us, and her name is?
Stella.
Stella. Stella, are you interested in art? Do you paint? Would you like to talk about it? No?
She's interested in music.
Oh, okay.
She's going to apply for a program here on WGXC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's thinking of doing that.
Cool. Yeah, you can do it. That's one of the cool things here is we have a lot of young people programming every day, in fact. Anyway, getting back to the book. So once again, you're going to, this Saturday,
6 o'clock at Golden Notebook, 29 Tinker Street in Woodstock, and then Friday, September 16th at 6 o'clock at the Jack Shaman Gallery /the school, 25 Broad Street in Kindergarten.
Okay. Right on the main street.
Right on
you can't miss it.
Yeah.
Please
attend. Great space.
Yeah.
And are you going to talk to Lily, or is it just his gig?
You never know. You never know what might happen.
You're going to exhibit any of the illustrations?
That's actually a really good question. You know, we have talked about trying to set up something like that, you know, especially the portraits. You know, I think that would be really a great show, especially if they're blown up, you know, made larger. Someone comes along, splatters a toothbrush full of paint on them just to give a little added something. Yeah, but I think that would be interesting.
So in the book, they're shown as black and white. Are they painted in black and white?
They actually are all done in black and white, and I love to work in black and white, you know, except for the cover. That's right.
Well, this is part of the beginners series.
It's a lengthy, lengthy series. Yeah, there's all
and
sorts
where
of
is that publisher? Is he somewhere in New England?
They're in Connecticut. Yeah. There's lots of titles coming out all the time. I think there's none of which I can think of right this second, of course, because suddenly I'm on the spot. But
There's, you know, Dadaism for beginners.
Right, there is.
Classical music for beginners.
This year's releases are Civil Rights for Beginners, Climate Change for Beginners, Proust for Beginners. Mormonism for beginners.
I should have known that.
Libertarianism for beginners. So
it runs the gamut.
Yeah.
It's a great series.
No, I've always been a fan of the series in its previous incarnations. Yeah. I didn't know it had sort of transmogrified into this now.
Yeah.
But I think it came out of the guy who was doing the writers and readers one at one point.
I should know this lineage. Yeah. At some point I did, but I forgot.
I remember when the first of these came out from Pantheon way back, were really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did Marx and Freud and Lenin and stuff like that.
I hope we've kept the coolness standard raised high.
This is one of the first ones, I think, where they actually, you know, allowed a painter to step in and not make it quite so much a graphic novel,
right.
You know, and really just more paintings to accompany text. So I'm excited about having had that opportunity.
You never thought of like a little cartoon of Jackson Pollock throwing paint or something like that?
In the past? You mean before?
No, for the book.
Oh, well, it's in there.
Oh, yeah. That's right. There is one. You're right.
Jackson
Pollock, I forgot.
Double spread.
That's right.
And there he is, splattering paint on the floor.
You're right.
He requires a double spread. That's
absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah, he probably would insist on it. You know.
And I like this. Is this, who is that? Is that Lee? No, it's Elaine de Kooning painting.
Kennedy.
Kennedy.
No. John F. Kennedy. That's pretty cool. Well, Ellen.
Anything else you'd like to know,
I
Mr. DiPietro?
No, that's sounds like a great... oh, I think Lily wants to get... Stella wants to get in here. Come on, Stella.
We're putting her on the spot now.
Oh, I love to put people on the spot. That's what I specialize in.
Yes, yes, he does.
So, Stella, what grade are you in?
Kay. She's going into seventh. I'm speaking for her. She loves
that. The microphone is far away.
Here we go.
I'm going to seventh grade.
And what school?
I'm homeschooled.
Oh, cool. And that's going okay?
Yeah, it's going really well. I do a whole bunch of subjects at home and stuff, and then I do different classes everywhere.
Right.
She's writing a lot of songs, actually. She's a singer-songwriter, so it's really
great. We have a really good program here that for homeschoolers as well. Kite's Nest, have you heard of that?
I think we have. Yeah.
She was a Kite's Nest person for a while.
Kite's Nest.
So. Cool. Well, that's cool.
We've discovered that, you know, a painter and a writer partnership can often produce a musician.
There you go.
We're not the only ones. We've actually researched this. So some kind of genetic thing.
It's not a scientific study.
Do you play any instruments?
Well, I sing and I play piano and I play clarinet.
Nice. Have you recorded yet? You got a contract?
My friend's father is a musician who actually won a Grammy. And he's a producer, too, for albums. And I recorded one song with him so far, but I'm going to record more in the future.
Great. Well, we'll keep an eye out for you're going to be on the show soon then, I guess.
Hopefully, yes.
We'll talk about that afterwards, I guess, right.
Okay, Ellen, let's wrap it up. We've been talking to Richard Klin and Lily Prince and Stella Klin Prince. What's the?
She's plain old Prince, just because I couldn't saddle her with Klin.
Yeah. And Stella Prince. And Saturday in Woodstock?
Saturday in Woodstock at Golden Notebook at 6 o'clock, and then at the Jack Shaman Gallery, the school, September 16th. That's a Friday, also at 6 o'clock.
Great. Well, thanks for coming in.
And very
thank
best
you
of
so
luck
much for having
with
us
with the book.
Very appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very
thank you.
Accessible.
Bye all.